Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. We're going to talk about two subjects today. First and most importantly, workplace bullying. It's a little known and little understood intimidation tactic that will be explained when one of the foremost experts on the subject, Dr. Gary Namy, who is co-founder with his wife, Dr. Ruth Namy, of the Workplace Bullying Institute in Bellingham, Washington, speaks on the MTSU campus from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, March 17th, in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building. This is a free and open event sponsored by the Distinguished Lecture Series and the Jennings A. Jones College of Business. And here with us today to talk about workplace bullying, our guest is a professor of management at MTSU, Dr. Jackie Gilbert, whose research interests include cross-cultural studies, human resource management, diversity, and gender issues. Her blog is called organizedforefficiency.com, where she has posted information about workplace bullying, among other subjects. And toward the end of this program, we'll lighten the conversation a bit and turn to the subject of getting organized, which is very timely as that spring cleaning time of year is upon us. Jackie, thank you for being with us today, and welcome. Glad to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Let's start with a definition of workplace bullying. What do you understand it to be?
Well, there are two types of bullying. There are physical and behavioral, but primarily I think bullying is defined in terms of uncivil interaction and specifically unexpected, rude, uncivil behavior at work.
And it can manifest itself in what types of ways? Are we talking about from peer-to-peer or supervisor to subordinate or subordinate up to supervisor?
Typically, it's top-down. It can, however, be peer-to-peer if there are differences in both tenure and job status.
Mm-hmm. And these could be things like, what, screaming at a person, cursing at a person, or can it be more subtle than that?
It can be more covert. There's a phenomenon known as selective incivility, where individuals who are high-performing, and this is typically women, are singled out for uncivil interactions at work or unsupportive behavior from their peers.
So these women are they good employees, hardworking, competent at what they do? Are they targeted because people are jealous of them, or are they targeted because they're perceived to be vulnerable in some way, or both?
I think jealousy is a huge factor, and I've always told my classes it's a mystery to me why some people put their effort into attacking those who are competent rather than putting their effort into improving their own job situation.
Into becoming more competent.
Into becoming more competent themselves.
Right. This sounds like a phenomenon that can create a very toxic work situation, and it seems to be counterproductive ultimately because it would cost the company, the employer, lots of time and productivity, does it not?
Well, no doubt. People spend time worrying about it. They spend time wondering what did they do to provoke the perpetrator. And I think employers, in the absence of a policy, in the absence of being proactive, they, in essence, shoot themselves in the foot.
Is there any sort of other component to workplace bullying, such as race or gender discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination or religious discrimination? These are categories that are codified in law as protected classes. Do any of these factors ever enter into a workplace bullying situation?
Well, they certainly can, but bullying many times is covert, and it's difficult to pinpoint the actual cause of the uncivil behavior. Why is it occurring? So it's difficult to pin that to a certain type of discrimination.
And so does the bullying target have difficulty in making himself or herself understood that this really is going on? I mean, are they told this is just a figment of your imagination, you're too sensitive, stuff like that?
That could be, and most oftentimes bosses don't want to deal with the bully because that's a messy relational issue, and it's easier simply to move on, and that way the bully becomes emboldened, and they feel that they can bulldoze other people with no repercussions.
Does the bully ever get away with it because the bully is has a special relationship with the manager himself or herself? In other words, it that employee could be the boss's, for lack of a better word, stooge or informer within the group of employees, and that that person is allowed to get away with whatever because he feeds the boss's ego or whatever special relationship is involved there.
That could be. The other reason is that people are simply scared of the bully. They've put other people on notice that if they're challenged, they're going to be very vehement in their reaction toward them. So people leave them alone, and therefore they comply their trade with no pushback from anybody else.
Has this intimidation ever reached the level of actual illegal physical threatening, calling people up at home and threatening them, or doing something to their car, having their car keyed or their tires punctured, or things of that nature? Has it gone to that kind of seemingly psychotic extreme?
Oh, that would be stalking.
Yeah.
And certainly stalking at work is a problem, and we typically think of it as a violent act, but stalking can occur over a period of years. It's a very intense form of intimidation in which many times the victim, if they have lesser status, they're unlikely to say anything. And this can take the form of repeated phone calls, of drive-bys, consistently trying to be in that person's face, but doing it outside of the realm of the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
So no one actually knows what's going on except the perpetrator and the victim.
You had a guest post on your blog by someone who said that a person who is bullied, a target of bullying, workplace bullying, could actually develop post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
If this goes on for a long... Now, a lot of people associate post-traumatic stress disorder with war, but actually people who are victims of rape can have developed post-traumatic stress disorder and other types of people. It's not just limited, this condition, to veterans returning from a war zone. Can you elaborate a little bit and talk about the psychological impact on the bully target?
Well, PTSD can result from an extreme occurrence of bullying, a one-time episode, or can result from something like stalking, something that occurs year after year, extended time frame in which the victim thinks they have no control over the situation. And psychologically, that manifests in a situation where mentally they can't escape. And so PTSD is an outgrowth of that.
And so the target of the bullying could end up spending money on psychologist or psychiatrist to try to help them figure out what's wrong with them.
With them. Yeah. When in actuality, what's manifesting is simply a toxic occurrence at work that no one has addressed, and perhaps there's no education, there's no policy, and the perpetrator, again, may be very high status with a lot of seniority, so people don't feel comfortable challenging that person.
Why does this phenomenon, and we all know that there are, we've all, you know, people have complained about bosses since there have been bosses and employees, and there are sites on the internet where that invite you to complain about your bad boss. However, that could be problematic because people who do that or put that on their Facebook page or tweet about it can be found out by the boss if they are computer savvy and know how to use the internet, and that can get them in even more trouble than they were in before. Why is there, has there been so little attention paid to this, to workplace bullying, seemingly, in this country? I don't hear a lot about it in the popular press, although Dr. Namey's name has been getting out there in recent years.
Well, possibly because there's no legislation. And the other reason on a micro level at work is because typically there are no consequences to the bully. They can engage in whatever behavior, and because people are either afraid, they simply don't want to deal with it, then things are brushed under the table. But regarding what you said about internet sites, I think people express covert dissatisfaction when they don't have the means to express themselves freely at work with the boss. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they feel intimidated, or if they feel they express what's truly on their minds, they're going to get in trouble. And so they use other means to say what they're truly feeling.
I could, I have no quantitative data to back it up, but I could certainly speculate that in tough economic times like this, with the unemployment rate so high, that the fear would be would increase exponentially of confronting the bully, especially if the bully is a supervisor, because you don't want a black mark against your name in your employment record, let alone risk getting fired. So I can see how this can get pressed underground. You mentioned that it's not codified in law right now. Dr. Namy is working on a law on legislation to try to outlaw workplace bullying. If it is as covert and as nuanced as you indicate, do you think it can be defined well enough in order to for there to be sanctions placed against the bully? Because this type of bullying can take so many different forms.
Well, certainly, and other countries have done that. It's actually illegal in Canada. Mm-hmm. And Scandinavia, I think, has done a lot of research in this area, more so even than any other country, from what I gather. But getting back to what you were saying about the free expression and going underground, mm-hmm. I love what Jack Campbell says. He has his employees rate him on a scale of 1 to 10. Mm-hmm. And if it's less than 10, then he asks them, what can I do to improve the situation? And I think it's up to the manager, the people in charge, to take the bull by the horns and to ask people, what can they do to improve? And typically you don't see that. You see the opposite.
Why is that? Is it it's difficult to find a manager who is secure enough about his or her own managerial skills to risk that kind of direct, honest feedback from their own employees?
Well, it can be painful. Mm-hmm. And Jack Campbell explains that himself in his book, Success Principles, which is one of my favorites, by the way. Mm-hmm. But certainly you have to be open to not only receiving the feedback, but to initiating the change in response to the feedback.
Right.
And something I've done in my online class this semester, my RODP class, is that I have a suggestion box for students. And they haven't been shy at all about giving feedback on the course and what they would like and what they would see different. And I've instituted actually some terrific improvements in the course because of their suggestions. So it's student driven.
Right.
And that feedback has truly been a gift to me.
You know, at the end of each semester, the students in each course are given a Scantron sheet to fill out, in which they are allowed to rate their professors and to answer very specific questions. The instrument has been revised over time, and the professor goes out of the room while the students are filling out their Scantron sheets so that there's not that intimidation factor there. And usually someone else's secretary or someone gives them the pencils and lets them fill it out and hand it back in without, you know, having the professor stand over their shoulder while they're doing this. Wouldn't it be interesting if not only the faculty members of a university, but also the employees in the non-academic units, the support personnel, could also be given that opportunity to rate their employers in a professional manner, in you know, something along those lines. It might not necessarily be the same instrument, but what do you think about that?
I think it's a matter of approachability. I don't necessarily think it needs to be quantified in a bubble scantron, as you're suggesting.
Right.
I feel
like if, I say, it could be a different instrument altogether.
I feel like if the manager has open communications with the people that they're supervising, I feel if there's an environment of equals, then you're going to have a more free and open exchange, and you're going to see an improvement in the work relationships.
But as a matter of developing a non-bullying policy, do you have any ideas on going about, whether it's a private sector business or a public center entity, developing a zero tolerance for bullying type policy that would help provide guidance for creating these less toxic workplaces?
Well, one thing that occurs regularly in workplaces that remains unaddressed for the most part is gossip. And clearly, that's counterproductive. It doesn't help the person who's doing it. It doesn't help the other person they're gossiping to. And doesn't help the victim of the gossip. So just defining some of these things and listing them is one step in promoting education in this area and awareness.
Education and awareness, but in terms of an actual human resources policy with procedures for going step by step through some sort of method of addressing it, the way one would go through a step-by-step method of addressing legal discrimination or allegations of legal discrimination, what can or should a company do?
Well, progressive discipline. First of all, investigate and see if there's any grounds for the allegations. And then I think it's important to have consequences in place. If individuals indeed have engaged in whatever it is they're accused of, then they need to be held accountable. And until that happens, I don't think you're going to have real change occurring.
Can those consequences, can and should the consequences be made known throughout the organization, or is it something that would have to remain part of someone's personnel file, kept confidential?
Well, that would differ on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the particular individual was accused of course. But I think in general, people can be made aware if your behavior rises to X level, then here's what's going to happen.
Right.
And it puts them on notice, and it lets everyone know in a transparent fashion what's going to occur.
What sort of a timeline does bullying follow? Are there stray incidents that happen here and there, or does it come in waves where there will be a peak of bullying activity at one point on the part of one manager or one individual, and then that'll hit a trough and then it'll come back in a wave again? How does it manifest itself over time?
I think people test the waters with a particular individual, and if there's no pushback, then they become more aggressive. And then that can develop into pack mentality, especially when the bully isn't challenged. And I tell my classes, some people are delighted for the opportunity to engage in bad behavior, and the rest of them are simply scared of the bully and want to hide behind them. And so they remain silent.
Right.
And the victim is left to fend for themselves.
And then also, are there people who form alliances with the bully for the sheer purpose of gravitating toward what they perceive to be a power center because they think that will protect them?
Right. They want to be on the winning side,
right,
in essence. And they want, again, what you're saying, the protection of the bully, and they most certainly don't want to be the bully's target.
It seems like the psychological equivalent of gang warfare, complete with everybody carving out their own little piece of turf.
Pack mentality. If left unaddressed, then it can be very toxic.
And Dr. Namy, once again, Dr. Gary Namy, co-founder of the Workplace Bullying Institute, will be speaking about that on the MTSU campus on Thursday, March 17th in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building. It's totally free. It is open to the public, and we invite you all to attend. good listeners, because it's a subject I think you'll find intriguing and perhaps even something that you can relate to in your own personal experience. And now let's go to Jackie's Organized for Efficiency blog, because all of us feel discombobulated about different things at different times in our life, and we're looking for some guidance. Oh, if I just had the time, this and that, you know, I don't have time to clean out the garage or whatever is going on in your own life. Why did you start this Organized for Efficiency blog?
Well, initially, Organized for Efficiency was a book.
Yeah.
And it evolved into a blog format so that I could reach thousands of people, mm-hmm. and also so I could expand my network of colleagues by including guest bloggers. But the reason I started it was in 2008. It was after I became full professor, and my office was full of stuff. And it was clogging my drawers. It was overtaking my bookcases. It was everywhere. It was unorganized stuff.
You know, that's true of a lot of professors on campus. I've seen that in a lot of professors' offices. Books will get piled up, papers, term papers, research stuff will get piled up, and sometimes the dust gets piled up on top of it because it's been that way for that long. And you ask some of them about it, and some of them will say, well, I just haven't gotten around to it. I'm teaching and grading papers and whatever. And others will say, well, I can't work any other way. Is that a canard, or is that just an excuse? Or
I think maybe they haven't tried to work another way. And the simple task of organizing your entire office, things you've been accumulating for years. I've been accumulating these things since graduate school. That was a daunting task. Mm-hmm. But I visualized what I wanted the finished product to look like.
Yeah.
And I kept that in the back of my mind. And I took the month of May 3 hours each day, and when the trash can was full, I left the office. And so from there, I had a baseline from which to further refine my efforts, and I've kept at it, and the pictures of the finished product are on my blog, organizeforefficiency.com.
Do you think people feel overwhelmed when they start to tackle an organizing project because they think they have to get it all done in one day as opposed to working on it gradually as you did?
Well, for me, it's been a process. I'm still doing small things, and there are still things I want to do for my classes that will further streamline the process of teaching so I won't have to keep reinventing the wheel. But once I have those things all done, which I think will be by fall 2011, mm-hmm. then I'll be in very good shape.
Is it important to set a deadline for yourself, even if that deadline is somewhere mm-hmm. off in the future?
A goal setting that focuses and energizes your efforts and gets you flying in formation. And when you set a goal, then you can also decide on what are the other things that I need to accomplish this goal. What are the materials? Who do I need to talk to? What do I need to research? And it keeps you moving forward.
Do you apply these same techniques in organizing yourself in your home environment too?
Yes. In fact, a lot of the artifacts in my office were things that I found in my home, things that really could be showcased in my bookshelf, and I could enjoy looking at them every day instead of having them stuffed into a drawer and perhaps falling into disrepair because they're squashed in a corner.
I think with regard to professors, I think the reason that they save so much stuff is partly because they feel they might have to go back and consult a bit of research that they ran across at some point in time, and they don't want to lose contact with that research. Of course, you can find a great deal on the internet these days, and surely the use of the computer helps reduce some of that hard copy clutter mm-hmm. in a person's office, wouldn't you think?
I think it's a matter of choice. For example, I don't receive the Academy of Management journals in paper anymore. I receive them online. Mm-hmm. So by getting things online, by eliminating mail I no longer want, by blocking emails I no longer want, I only focus on the things that are truly important. And it's been very simplifying to how I do my business each day.
Is your process, is it adaptable to any type of work situation, physical or mental, indoor or outdoor? I mean, could I take what you put on your blog and apply it to any kind of a job, regardless of whether it takes place in an office or not?
Well, I think it's eliminating the unnecessary and eliminating the repetitive. Mm-hmm. What can I do for a one-time effort to keep from reinventing the wheel? Mm-hmm. How can I use what's available and not have to either purchase more products, involve more people? How can I simplify this in to only the basic elements?
And do you think that as you continue to grow and refine the process, do you think that this has helped make you a better professor? Have you seen it manifest itself, your organizational skills manifest themselves in as you go about your job, as you teach?
Well, certainly the blog is part of that. Not only do I talk about organizing, both behavioral and physical, on the blog, but I use those posts in my teaching. Mm-hmm. And they're readily available. They're right there. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to direct students to specific blog posts I've written either for them, for that particular topic, or in general that might apply to what we're talking about that week.
I can see where this could be very beneficial to the students themselves, because one of the recurring issues in a college campus environment that we hear about all the time is how students study, how they organize their time management skills, their study management skills, how they organize their notes, how they prepare for a test. It's very much, it has a practical application in their lives directly as well, does it not?
Well, it does. And one thing that I've started doing this semester, I have more time since I'm more organized. I've taken that spare time and I've started to learn some new skills. For example, I've automated my PowerPoints to where they have a webcam picture of me. So I'm talking in a little talking head in the right-hand corner of the PowerPoint, and students are able to see me. I'm not sure if they want to see me, but they get to see me.
I think it's highly appropriate. What other projects do you have lined up for yourself in the future?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because my students are working on a very exciting project.
Yeah?
This is my Principles of Management class, my Tuesday night class. Mm-hmm. And I divided them into six groups. And the groups will be presenting on an aspect of bullying, a unique aspect. They're hazing, cyberbullying, corporate bullying, bullying in the school system, mobbing, and stalking. These presentations will be videotaped, and the highlights will be made into a 4.5 to 5 minute YouTube video to be distributed to educational institutions across the country.
That's remarkable. And they're going to, are they going to take situations that they are personally aware of, or are they going to investigate other situations and try to analyze that have occurred outside their own personal experience and try to analyze those?
No, they're doing research. Mm-hmm. So with each group, I'm working very closely with them. I'm meeting with them informally, and they're also going to have a formal practice session in the LRC Room T, which is where they'll be taped before they go live.
Would you like to see this become a permanently integrated part of classes semester after semester after semester? I mean, not just for this one time, but to have classes continue to do this year after year after year?
Oh, certainly. And if other educators are aware of this, then perhaps they can replicate this same type of educational experience in their own universities.
So we could have something that would grow and expand to colleges
across the country.
Across the country
and
even
the world.
Around the world.
Yes.
I think that's absolutely magnificent.
So students making other students and the general populace aware of the bullying phenomenon and educating people their own age.
I wish you and your students the best of luck with that. As someone who has been reading Dr. Namy's literature for quite some time and has been aware of this situation on a deeply personal level and has had colleagues who have been in contact with it on a deeply personal level, I think it's a marvelous thing. And Dr. Jackie Gilbert, I want to thank you for being our guest today on MTSU on the Record.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.